Hello and welcome to The Culture Brokers, stories from 1.5 generation immigrants. In this series, we explore the unique experiences of individuals who immigrate to a new country before adolescence. Each episode will discuss different themes relevant to this demographic as they navigate through life while trying to understand what it means to belong to different cultures.
If we're on a Scarborough Love Fest, my favorite thing is to walk down a hallway in any of the Crescent Town buildings and just like breathe that in. Exactly. Breathe that in for a minute. Like that to me is like one of the most magical smells, man. And like, and of course, growing up, you're told that like that's a gross smell. That's a bad smell. It's like, oh, that smells. And you're supposed to believe that it's a bad smell, but it doesn't matter, man. You get off at any floor in one of those buildings.
Hi, everyone. On this episode, Mana and I sat down with our guests, Sadie Muktadir and Andrew Doe, the storytellers behind Six Spots, which the two created to showcase small eateries by immigrants and new Canadians in Toronto. We talk about food as an easy entry point to conversations around multiculturalism and diversity, who gets to claim authenticity in cuisine and what that really means, and what used to be considered stinky lunches when we were growing up. If you consider yourself a foodie, then this one's for you. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
I'm Andrew. I don't know if I count as a Gen 1.5 because I was born and raised here, although I did live in the U.S. And I think when people say Gen 1.5, they don't mean someone who immigrated from America.
Yeah, we're not very strict about what 1.5 means.
That doesn't really count, but... I was born here. My mom is American. My dad is Canadian. They're both refugees. They're both Vietnamese refugees. They both went up the war and, as a function of the war. My mom ended up in the States. My dad ended up in Canada. They didn't know each other. It was because my dad was in the same refugee camp as one of my mom's relatives. And apparently my dad and this guy were like volleyball buds in the refugee camp. So like you ask my dad, it's like, what was it like? And he's like, yeah, it's not so bad. I had a lot of fun. I played a lot of volleyball. People bet on me, gave me cigarettes, and don't tell your mother, and all these. I did all these other fun things. So that was my dad, and then my mom landed in rural, like central Illinois. Like I remember weird, distinct memories of like living in a trailer park and all that. But then we would go there every summer because our cousins lived there. I'm functionally born and raised here in Toronto.
Why did you decide to do Six Spots?
Sadie. Why did you decide?
Sorry, I'm asking their question, but that was part of their question.
I think Toronto is a diverse food scene. I think everybody likes eating out, and I think at the time, Sadie and I forget where we were just hanging out, eating a meal or whatever. And then we just like saw a restaurant close and you see the family eating dinner like after a service, like and they let us stay for a little bit after. And then you can kind of see like a family meal happening in the back with the owners. And we're like, you know what, like a lot of food media here just kind of covers like the reviews of the food, takes really nice photos of the food. We don't really know much about the people behind the food. So, me and Sadie were like, this seems like an opportunity to surface interesting stories, because that's something Sadie and I really, really enjoy doing. And let's just go around and let's just try to find out. And we kind of made it a point to be like, we don't really know if the owners are migrants per se, but we just had this vision of like, we really just want to cover people of color and really try to understand kind of like their story, why they got in the restaurant business, and like what advice would they give. And it was really fun. And kind of what we found with that is that the people who read the website weren't necessarily like people looking, like you don't go to that website necessarily to check out the restaurant, but what we heard is like some, like from other restaurant owners and like some kitchen staff and some chefs, they were like, oh, we've heard about this. We read it because it's just kind of like, oh, because we can actually see like ourselves in some of these stories. So it's kind of like a nice validation that to hear and other chefs kind of using it for that purpose. Yes. So Sadie, why Six Spots? Would you like to add?
Oh yeah. So I'm Sadie, born in Toronto as well. My parents are from Sylhet, Bangladesh. And, I think I was just growing up in the 90s, I sort of saw the look of the city sort of change. I remember being like very young as a child, like 5-6 years old in grade school, and sort of definitely being like one of the only Bengali kids. And then sort of seeing that wave happen in the mid 90s, late 90s, as more and more people came over. So, by the time by the time I was like 22, you know, I moved out of my parents' place, and my entire life I had sort of taken that community and my mom's food and my parents' food for granted. Like I just, it was always just a given that I'd go home and I'd eat, and the food I would eat would be great, but I didn't even consider it great. It was just, that was just home cooking and that was just regular food. And then once I moved out, I realized, like, you know, I was eating candy for dinner and like just garbage, right? And you know, I was going out to eat so much, and then like that's when it first like clicked to me that like, wait a minute, I had it so good at home, like in terms of food, like, and I was eating out so often, trying to, you know, find like just comparable or something good, that I realized that I didn't just want to, I don't know how to say this, but I didn't just want to like eat without also doing something for the restaurant. Like it just felt weird. Like it just felt like,
yeah.
It just felt like Andrew and I were in an interesting position where we could do something for the restaurant, even though like it felt, you know, even though we were of course paying for our meals and everything, it just felt like if we were going to eat at these great places, maybe, you know, we may as well do something with it. We may as well do something productive with, you know, the time that we're spending here. And then the other reason why I wanted to do that was because, you know, on Andrew's point about like in food media, I knew that if we started asking a lot of these chefs and owners questions, their answers were going to be very different from the answers that you'd get in like BlogTO or Toronto Life from those chefs. Like the reason why those chefs opened a restaurant are very different from the reasons why, you know, chefs that restaurants we were at opened restaurants. Like they, you know, so we knew that there were going to be a lot of different answers. And so I wasn't sure how many people knew about that. So I just, that was something that we wanted to highlight when we started.
So what I find interesting when I'm reading through the interviews that you guys had, or at least like a few of them, is there is obviously this focus on the food, like the restaurateur, but about their stories and about their lives outside of just producing this like ethnically mm-hmm. focused food. And like a couple of the interviews you've done, I recognize seeing that restaurant featured on something like a platform like BlogTO as well, but it's just like, which makes it even more interesting to kind of like compare and contrast the two stories. And what like immediately just stuck out to me was like, yeah, these are people with so many other multidisciplinary facets to their character and to their stories. And it's not just this like great immigrant story of like, hey, we came here and Canada gave us this opportunity and here we are. It was like, you know, like I am studying law school, or I, my parents who are, or my entire family who's in this business with me, they have that degree there in like banking, or like it's just such a diverse and just multifaceted story, you know, to each person's interview. And that made me kind of go beyond this lens as a reader of like okay, let me put it this way. Like even myself, sometimes when I'm reading these stories on BlogTO, I start to like paint this picture of this person who like, you know, what their lives could have been back home, and you know, like having this image of them eating this traditional meal with their family member, and now they're here, and it's such a nostalgic thing. So I'm kind of like catching myself. I fall into the trap of basically what they're trying to get me to think about the person. And then when I read the interviews that you guys are saying, I keep like, I'm not able to do that. I actually have to focus on the story that is being presented to me, which is one that goes beyond my biases of what it means to be an immigrant in Canada and decide to start like a small business, you know? So I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about like why you guys chose to structure the interviews that you did, how you went about picking the restaurants that you featured. And just like why you had that urge, or like at least why do you think you had that kind of instinct that there is more to say here than just go sit at a restaurant, take a good picture of the food?
Well, I know like, I know Andrew can vouch for this as well, but like so many of our family members, cousins, family friends work in restaurants. So that was something that, you know, me specifically, I can say I already knew, right? Like everyone knows a Bengali in a restaurant, right? Like you go to any kitchen in Toronto, there's going to be a guy in the back who's Tamil, Filipino, or Bengali, right? So, you know, I had multiple family friends and stuff. So I knew that there was always more to their story than just, you know, even coming here with a dream to open a restaurant. Like so many of them, it was just, you know, something that they had to do. I knew that they were at George Brown College or at U of T doing a degree, and then some laundromat opened up for sale, and, you know, they all pulled their money together, and they said, oh, you know what, this kind of food is really hot right now. Let's see if we can do something with it. But, you know, as for how we went about picking the restaurants, I mean, I don't know if we had like a an organized system. I know we had like a short list, right, like of places that we really wanted to interview. A lot of the time people would just email us, or friends would give us recommendations, or things like that. It wasn't really, sometimes we just walk into the place and we'd have a really good meal and be like, hey, are you free for like half an hour right now? Like we have some questions and stuff, and they'd be down for that.
Yeah. Yeah. There wasn't really a criteria. I think in my case, it's just kind of like, I mean, my mom always wanted to open a bakery, specifically a French bakery, because in Vietnam, you know, there's a very strong French pastry tradition. I mean, I'm literally making French pastries right now. And I was actually taught by my mom, because it was part of like their church bake sales, to like make these like very elaborate like flans and profiteroles, and like all those types of like very classic like French sort of desserts are things that I, as a kid, was actually like taught how to make, because it was, you know, because the thing is just like, you're gonna have to help mom and dad do a certain thing. So like that was a thing. But then, you know, my mom had health issues, so like that dream never really went anywhere. But it's something she's talked about wanting to do. So it's just kind of because she actually just really, really enjoys she really enjoys this, and now she's obviously very happy that I'm able to do it too. Although she'll always say that I'm not as good as her, which whatever, I can accept that. But going back to kind of like what was the question, like why we decided to do this and what we were one of the one, I think there was like one of the earlier, you mentioned something earlier about like really understanding these people beyond the production of food, right? And I think in Toronto, like the way we kind of tell ourselves is like we're a very diverse city, and it's very multicultural. I mean, that is the Canadian kind of like myth, if you will. And we are diverse, but the way that I think was frustrating for us that we kind of came to realize later is that the way diversity is sort of experienced here is like, or multiculturalism experienced here is like through an easy entry point of like food. And like something we always took issue with is like food connects people. I mean, it's a medium in which to do people, but food doesn't connect people. People connect people. And so that was like something that always kind of stuck out to me, is like, we really want to understand these people beyond the production and really the value, the quote unquote value they provide to like multiculturalism and all that. And on the flip side, the way that people experience multiculturalism is like, oh, I have like a good example when people ask me where I'm from, which depending on who's asking, I will either be like, oh yeah, you know, my parents are from Vietnam, or I'll just be like, I'm from Toronto. Cause it really depends on who's asking, right? Like sometimes it's like, it's a genuine question of like, oh, I'm just trying to connect with this person. And I'm also from like somewhere else. And you know, that's a way to make home, versus like, where are you from? Where are you really from? Right. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So depending on who's asking, I'll just outright say it. But then often every time I say is like, you know, my parents are like from Vietnamese refugees, immediately someone has to be like, I have a favorite pho place. I'm like, okay. Like, and I think that's happens all the time. And I think there's like something to that where it's just kind of like the only way you understand like multiculturalism or like me being like a Vietnamese Canadian is through my food. And it is an easy entry point, but it's just kind of like, what do you know beyond food, beyond our food? And I think that is like something that we wanted to like try to take on through the entry, like food as a very easy entry point in which to experience different cultures and thing. But I think like the thing that we've kind of seen and have noticed is just like, it just kind of stops there.
I love that you raise that, because I think so much of what we talk about is about understanding the nuances of culture and what that means, right? So I remember one of our mutual friends described a lot of identity as like this iceberg metaphor, where there's just layers and things you can see and things that are hidden. And things that are easy entry points, like you just said, Andrew, like food, clothing, even, you know, language to a certain extent,
music,
exactly. You know, just the things that we can celebrate. But beyond that, there's all these other nuances to what culture really means. And that's what 1.5, a lot of times you're grappling, whether or not you're a 1.5 in the traditional sense or not. It's realizing people think in certain ways. You know, when you said, it depends on who's asking you the question. For me, and, you know, Sadie, you said you're Bengali. A lot of Bengali people love asking very personal questions. Like,
how much money do you make? Like, what, like, how much do you weigh? What, like, does your skin always look like that? Like, just really invasive things. And I think those are really important. And with food, I didn't even think about it until you guys raised it. But I was also, like, realizing that so much of what we see as traditional or cultural cuisine is just distilled down to a certain national identity. Like, I don't, like, even when you say French cuisine, I just know what palatable French cuisine in Canada would be marketed as or commodified as. And it makes me think, like, there's so much aspects of cuisine that are so diverse, but you're only seeing one part of it that is, you know, a good entry point. And it kind of makes me wonder, like, are there certain national cuisines that are not worthy of, like, separate attention? And even within the same restaurant, right? Like, maybe pho is, like, the focus point, but there might be so much more that's being offered by that same restaurant that people don't want to engage in because it doesn't – I don't know if you guys are on Twitter, but, like, there was, like, this big thing happening a few weeks or maybe a month ago now where people were trying traditional food that they'd seen trending. And, like, I know in Nigeria there's, like, a lot of amala. People have a lot of amala. And people were – and organane, like, fufu, which I've tried in Ghana. And people were buying it, like, Americans, and doing, like, a live recording of their reaction to eating it. And some of it was really rude. Like, some of it was very disrespectful to be like, oh, my God, this hype is overinflated. This tastes like, you know, abysmal reactions in real time to eating this. And it's so much, it made me wonder, like, so much of it is, like, trend, like, what's going, what's considered aesthetic. There's, like, all these layers into what makes something even worth engaging. And so much of food from people who are not in the Food Network is, like, on Instagram, right? Like, just food pictures, and then that's the end of that engagement. So I'm wondering if you'd experienced that at all with, like, seeing things from the sidelines.
100%. Oh, 100%. One of the you mentioned, like, one of the restaurants, like, oh yeah, one of the chef owners is actually a court clerk with the Ontario Superior Court. This is actually the Naan and Kebab chain. If you've ever eaten there, you know, a nice Afghan franchise, very, very successful franchise, and a cool story. But I remember going there, and we were sort of invited to, like, this, like, you know, food blogger, whatever, and, you know, they thought that we were reviewing food. It's like, no, we really want to, like, know your story and, like, your kitchen staff story, the people who work for you. And so, like, we didn't quite fit in, but for whatever reason, they wanted us to, like, take photos and all that, which we did, but, like, we weren't there to necessarily review the food, and they insisted on giving a free meal, which I think is, like, another interesting thing about, like, about kind of, like, the hospitality tradition. I mean, in that context, it's because, like, obviously they wanted to promote their restaurant, but we've gotten offered free meals every time we go, and we always make it a point to be like, no, you're a small business, we want to support your restaurant, we don't want it to be a free meal. In spite of that, even though after we pay, they still give us free stuff after. Like, that has happened countless amount of times. But going back to this naan and kebab thing, it was like a gathering of, like, all these other food reviewers. I want to say there was, like, maybe, like, 9 or 10 kind of, like, our Instagram food reviewers or, like, people who work for Sonal Papers. And I just remember that the chef there was just setting up, giving people, like, a free meal, setting it up is like, oh yeah, you know, like, in the, and, like, I'll tell you, like, how our family does it, and this is, like, the order in which we like to sequence things, and, like, this is why we place things, like, this certain way. But all the other photographers were like, can you move that there? Can you move that there? Can you move that there? We're going to take all these photos. And, like, I just remember we were just really like, what the hell? You're all getting a free meal. And I think, like, it was from that moment, it was like, I hope no one ever calls me a food blogger or whatever. Like, it really does, right? for that purpose, because it's just kind of like, I just thought it was just kind of like the chef literally made a free meal, and he's explaining, like, the reason why he's setting the table a particular way. And for whatever reason, like, that story wasn't really respected. And on the top of that, once they tasted the food, it's like, oh, it's just good. It's good. It's good. It's this. It's not as good as that. Like, really, in my view, just really harsh, not harsh criticism, but just like, I guess the owners knew why they brought these people here, and they were prepared to receive those kind of remarks. But at the same time, that's not what we want to do. Like, that's not.
Yeah. To Tassin's point, the only thing I wanted to say was, one of my favorite questions to ask the restaurants we interviewed was, is there anything not on your menu that you want to add, or you're curious, or is there anything on your menu you wish people would order more? Or is there anything on your menu that, like, you're sort of on the fence about, right? Where you're like, I don't know if people would really vibe with this. Should I add it or should I not? And like, some of the answers we got were like really awesome and interesting. Like, I know this, I can't remember what the dish is, but I know the Syrian restaurant that we interviewed gave us some good answers on that. And it's always really interesting to see, like, their eyes usually light up at that question a lot. And they usually, if it's either no, like they put everything on the menu, or if they have something, they really do have like a couple things that they want to share, but they're not sure how it's gonna go. So yeah, that was just to, like, I think that's them trying to sort of combat that question of, like, you know, having a national cuisine, or combating that, like, you know, that very, that limiting, I guess, view of having just like one type of cuisine and one type of food.
It is interesting that, like, from all these places, you could probably identify like a national dish, like Vietnam, like national dish easily pho, like that's Bangladesh. I'm not sure, like, would it be shuki or something? Like, I'd
probably
right? Or I don't know what it would be in Iran, but like, what is the national dish in Canada? I don't really know if we have. I mean, yes, people would say poutine and Nanaimo bars and all these kinds of things, but like, is there really a Canadian national dish? And I don't, like, is there anything that's strongly associated other than maybe poutine, which is like
poutine.
Very regional, to be very clear. I mean, yes, everywhere in Canada can serve it, but it's very much a regional French Canadian thing.
Definitely.
So it's like interesting that we talk about kind of like this national cuisine, but it's actually like, I guess, like, it would be immigrants who came to, I guess, Canada that are bringing kind of like their national cuisines or national dishes in kind of importing it into Canada. And I remember getting into, like, you know, just a friendly conversation with a friend of being like, I would argue that, you know, pho, butter chicken, whatever the case is Canadian cuisine. And I was like, no, it's not. Just because we allow diversity doesn't make it. And just because it happens that, like, a restaurant serves this thing in Canada does not make it Canadian.
Okay, but then that brings up the question of the UK. Remember how the whole big thing in the UK now is them saying, like, butter chicken is a UK nationality. It's like their national
really?
Thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. So I go to the British
audacity never stops.
I go to British themed pubs, and like, I understand butter chicken being there, but I have seen specifically, like, you know, Britain claiming, you know, butter chicken as theirs. Right, like, that's the thing they put out next to fish and chips. And
I was gonna say, I thought it's fish and chips. They already have one.
Well, clearly, you know, frying fish is, you know, but so that's why it's like, when does pho get to be Canadian cuisine?
Yeah, and I would argue it doesn't need to, because I mean, I think the one thing with Canada is you can be very much like a hyphenated Canadian in a way that isn't as true, because I've also, now that I've lived in the States, it's not as true in the US. It's also weird. I'm subsumed under this like Asian American umbrella, which there's really no strong identity marker of Asian Canadian in quite the same way as like Asian American, which is a whole other conversation to get into. And I can obviously share reflections on that. And I have very mixed feelings about all that as well, but that's a wholly different conversation.
For sure. I mean, I think there's like in academia, there's a lot on that as well. Like, which one's better? The fact that immigrants in Canada just say they're Canadian, or that in the States, they always say I'm like Iranian American. Which one's more a true reflection of the immigrant experience, basically. But I want to go back to something Saadi said, because that was exactly my experience with my family once going to a Persian restaurant in Toronto. So I don't know if you guys know, but there's this chain. Well, they don't have the same name, but they're same owners of Persian restaurants on College Street, Pomegranate, Sherzad, and Akhtatavus. So they are, I would say, probably like the most favorite of my family, and most like most of the diaspora is like choice, basically, when it comes to wanting to dine out. And if we have like a family member or friend visiting from out of country, that's where we'll take them. So like really, for the most part, like authentic, proper Persian food. One of the items on, and so Takhtatavus has, it specializes in like breakfast cuisine. And one of their dishes is called kelle poche, which is very similar to the dish that you reference in the Syrian refugee interview that you did, where there's like, you know, it's a stew and there's like, I don't know, like brain and tongue and other intestines and all that. And it is incredibly popular. And one of those dishes that like my grandmother eats a lot, or like her grandmother ate like regularly, but maybe not so much like our generation. But I think like the one of the really interesting experiences we had as a family was when the first time we went there, we saw it on the menu, and that's not really that common. You wouldn't, like, especially like a Toronto downtown restaurant, that's usually like watered down, let's just say that. And we ordered it, and the dish was, it didn't look exactly like how my grandmother remembered it to. And she was like a little bit disappointed, you know, and then she like has it and she's like, okay, it's good. But like tastes like that. But it's like the, instead of having the actual pieces of like the intestines there, which like separately they've like blended it all in. So it kind of looks like one consistent stew. And it's just in many different ways. It's like some of the most like they might have a lot of the tongue, but they might not have a lot of the brain, which like makes it maybe more acceptable here, but it's not as authentic. Anyway, so we had like a whole, you know, experience with that. And my dad, I remember actually like defending it and being like, he was excited by the fact that they had done this. That he, to him, this was a nice way to introduce to the white people or the Canadians or the non-Persians in the restaurant. Just give them a little taste of what Persian cuisine is like, but without scaring them off. And my grandmother was just like disappointed. She didn't give a crap about that whole thing. She was like, I wanted my freaking proper stew. Anyways, so what I'm thinking about is, and to be honest, like every time I've thought about this issue, I always like, I can't take away my parents' like voice at the back of my head, which is that they don't want, they're happy with just 10% or 50% of exposure to Persian culture. That makes them, like when we're at that restaurant and every single time, and like out of all the families there, one family's white, they get really excited by that idea. They're like, oh, finally, it's like our little window of opportunity to connect. Whereas I'm sitting there like grumpy as hell because of, I'm thinking about all the things we're talking about, right? Like, why do we have to be so, you know, like grateful that they've chosen to visit our restaurant, something like that, you know? I don't know. Me and Tassin always talk about this, and I don't think like one has to be right and the other has to be wrong, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Like, even if it's basically like a shallow exposure to the culture or to the different multicultures in the city, is it still some like sign of progress?
I think I'm more on your grandmother's side. I think like if I was like in a restaurant, yeah, and like and I saw like Elishmas or Shuki on the menu, and I ate it, and it was like, it was, you like, you got to do that 100%. Like, you can't, with dishes like that, like, for me, it's like, you're doing it a disservice. Like, if you're making it more palatable for white people, like, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm on your grandmother's side. I'm like, you know what, it's like, it's not, like, they gotta eat it the way it was made, or like.
It's not about you.
Yeah, it's like, you know what I mean? Like, that dish was made that way for a reason, right? Like, and that reason wasn't you, like, so. You know, get with the program.
I'm closer to I guess your parents, somewhere in between actually, because like a Vietnamese restaurant, you go inside, the menus 300 different items, and I mean, I've always had a take where it's just like, I think the menu could be trimmed down and just focus on the things that they do really well in. And there's a reason they serve, all Vietnamese restaurants will all serve pho, right? And if you try to order all the other soups, like I can tell that like this is derived from like the broth you would use to make pho. Like, for example, one of my favorite dishes, bún bò Huế, which is a stop, which is like a very lemongrassy, very heavy soup, very, very lemongrassy soup, to the point that you will like cough on like just how lemongrassy it is. And then I'll go to like a Vietnamese restaurant, and like it's not really a dish that is ordered that often. Most people don't know about it. And then when I order it, it's just kind of like, okay, I can tell that the broth is like, this is just a pho stock. And I don't blame it, because like, I don't blame them. And a lot of my parents' complaints about like going to Vietnamese restaurants is that the broth is not as like, isn't as like flavored as what we make it at home. And it makes a lot of economic sense. Like trying to like, it would be very, you cannot sell like a bowl of like medium, like a big bowl of pho for like $6 if you were trying to make it home style. Like it's just not possible. You would have to like, it would have to cost a lot more if you want it like closer to like what I'm used to. So on one hand, it's just kind of like, well, it's kind of like the entry point, and then hopefully other people branch out and try things. And I'm okay if people try things, because like there are elements that they get right, and there are other elements that are like disappointing. But I also understand the economics of like why it doesn't make sense to like having to like have separate like big stock pots of very different stocks that are made in very, very different ways. Is just, that's just too time consuming. And many of these family restaurants, it's like they enlist their kids to like help them, and these kids are probably kind of resentful of it. Like, I know I certainly resented having to like, okay, I need to like pipe these things for like my mom so that she can like do it for her like church group. And I don't even really like all the aunts and uncles there at all. They always talk shit about me, and I know they talk shit about me, but whatever, it's family. So I'll do it. I'm kind of a different opinion, but I also like understand that, like, you know, short of like going and inside someone's home, you're just not, it's going to be very hard to replicate the real thing. And because a restaurant at the end of the day is a business, and the audience with money are, you know, your entertainment. I mean, we too are also kind of audience. There's such been like an explosion of like food as like an expression of self now, that's definitely more prominent like nowadays than say when we first, you know, graduated, or even when we first started this. So I don't blame restaurants for doing it, because it is a business and the profit margins are razor thin. And from many of our interviews, the reason that many of these owners got into it is because they couldn't find real work. They had no Canadian experience, but what they knew how to do was they knew how to cook. Like one of our favorite restaurants, it's this Tibetan restaurant, Momo. This man literally started his restaurant in his ESL class. He literally brought momos and tried to hustle his classmates. He was like, buy my momos. And his ESL teacher was like, these are good. These taste like the ones back home in India. And then he got his restaurant running just from that. And I mean, how he got his space is a whole other story. How he hustled a cancer patient, which is another weird story in itself. But like the community actually pitched in money to like help him raise the funds to like get the capital to actually buy this space. So he's one of the few owners that actually owns the place, like actually owns like the land and the property, which is very rare for a restaurant. People believed in that project because, yeah, he just started selling his dumplings in ESL class. Like, I don't, but when you ask him, he's like, what I really wanted to do was like, you know, work a job. I didn't want to be on welfare and all those kinds of things, but I couldn't find work. The only work I could do was this.
There's so much to say about what you've just said, Andrew. Like, my mind is sort of reeling at a few things. So first of all, I love this image, Mana, of you and your family taking a Persian, whole ass Persian family going out to dinner at another Persian restaurant. It's just like, my mom refuses to eat anything in the South Asian cuisine realm when we go out, because she's like, I don't want to pay money for food that I can't make at home. And that's her whole thing.
That's my mom.
But it's just, there's just something about, and right now, like COVID nostalgia, just like being with your cousins and relatives in a restaurant, especially people who are visiting, like my heart is just soaring at that. But I wanted to sort of touch on what Andrew said around, you know, limited options for newcomers to Canada. And sort of, I think that is a really important thing to center in response to the question that you had raised, Mana, around like, what does it mean for progress, right? So right now I'm studying immigration law and like citizenship law. I mean, there's so many barriers to that entry point for newcomers. So while there is this very valid, sort of romanticization of like the immigrant dream of people coming and integrating themselves, and then they're really the pioneers, like people who started bringing over like spices, like the Shan spices and the other, you know, like dried fish and other things they're importing from their homeland. Like those are the pioneers of creating like ethnic enclaves in Canada, period. Like you wouldn't have even the mom and dad who are able to make those cuisines at home if it wasn't for somebody in the community that already had noticed the need for that and the lack of it. And then they brought it over. And now you have a little shop that you go to that has all the things that you need, right? But the people that, it's not like Canada facilitates that, the ability to do this. And so much of, you know, folks who are coming in through economic streams to Canada and the criteria for what it means to demonstrate that you can economically establish yourself, which is what the legislation and the regulations in Canada look for. Like, you have to prove that you are going to be able to economically establish yourself in Canada for you to be worth us giving you this opportunity. And, you know, there's a whole like national occupation classification, which is like coded of what certain roles are in food attendants.
My old job, I had to deal with NOCs and all that
stuff. Oh my God, brutal. I had to deal with them too, like coding them. I just know how BS they are, but it's just, there's a literal hierarchy, right? Of like, you can have a chef at the top who's specialized, and unless you can prove some sort of like credentials to back that up, anything that's like food handling is like at the bottom of the list. And even if you have a job offer in Canada that will tell you that, hey, you can come work at this restaurant, which is networking, which is what we're taught in Canada, the value of networking, go and meet someone, maybe they can give you a job, right? In immigration, networking is like a sin. Like if you, it's like, why is this person offering you employment? Like there's no, it's so suspicious. There's so much case law of people who are denied permanent residence because it's like no one could possibly offer you a job in this area. Like it doesn't seem like you're qualified, you don't have anything to back it up. And so there's so many barriers, all that to say that this whole market of food that some folks are, you know, going into, and like not to take away anyone's agency and like power in doing that, that's not what I'm saying at all, but I think it's really hard to see progress when your consumers, yes, they're engaging with your food, you know, they're enjoying this part of your identity, your culture identity, your regional identity, for the, you know, 20 minutes to the hour that they're in your restaurant eating your food. They might go and tell their coworkers on Monday, like, oh my God, I just tried pho this weekend, right? But then what's also happening is folks are having this food and then they think that they have this like ability to critique, like they suddenly have that empowerment where they're like, oh well, this isn't like really good Thai food. Like I hear that about Thai food all the time. I don't know what it is about Thai food and white people, but they love Thai food. And people, and even my own friends who are, you know, my friends that are non-white will have pad Thai somewhere and they'll say, oh well, that's not really, it wasn't as good as like so and so. And I think there's a natural tendency to compare and contrast, and that's fine. But when you start assuming that you have some sort of like claim on what authenticity looks like, you know, and there's no credit given to the culture or anything about the people that are creating this food, bringing this cuisine for you to experience, then you were so far removed from the realm of progress entirely, because now we're just engaging with things at a very superficial level. And then I feel like people know that one part of your cuisine or whatever, then that's all they know. I'm not sure, like what Andrew said, maybe it'll help people try out new foods or try out new things. Ideally, yeah. Like ideally the connection can be made between food and let's say something else easily palatable, like music or television. Like, oh, I'm going to watch this really, I saw this like show. It's, you know, it has a Vietnamese lead. Like I, you know, let me make this connection and see what that's all about. Right. But I don't know if that's happening. And I think that's the part that I really struggle with, because, yeah, I think, and this is definitely part of what happens when immigrants are creating these senses of belonging for themselves, because maybe there is some ownership that starts to come into play. Like, you know, when Sadi said ilishmach and shutki, which is like two types of fish, one of them is like dried fish. I don't know if then slowly we're like, this is the only way to enjoy it because this is how I had it at home. And that's so personal to us that we're no longer going to allow other people to enjoy it outside of our terms. And so like that kind of makes the whole equation a little bit messy. But I definitely think that, you know, I don't know if food can, it's really hard for me, like based on what I'm like hearing from you both, to attest to the fact that food can be some sort of like, you know, like the punch through, like stop racism. And like, that's what's going to bring us all at the same table.
So can I just add to that? I think you're touching on something that is really dear to our heart. And part of the reason we also started this and something we reflect that's implicit and tacit, but isn't, but it's just like, I think, you know, food is inherently political. And I think just the way that the consumption of food is and the way food media and, you know, good vibes only, you know, like that kind of stuff is an attempt to try to depoliticize like food and kind of decontextualize it. So I'll say it like from the perspective of, you know, diaspora. There's something about like the taste making and the gatekeeping and like whether this food is authentic, that just evokes this visceral reaction. Like I remember when Bon Appetit, they featured this like video of this like white Philly chef. He's like, this is the proper way to eat pho. Literally the Vietnamese diaspora like went nuts. Like just absolutely, I remember it. Like even my mom and dad heard about it and they're like, who is this guy? He wouldn't survive in the jungles of Vietnam. I would stab him away. That's what my dad would say, right? Who is this guy, right? So like it really inspired a strong response, but there's something interesting about kind of like how like the politicization of food has just kind of stopped there because it's kind of like, you know, this authenticity. And it's kind of like, that is kind of like what encourages people to like speak out and do all that. At the same time, it's just kind of like, you know, I don't want to discount like how important that is because, you know, people have strong feelings about it. Food is so political and so personal. It's so, you know, there's such a symbolism of comfort there. You like literally asking anyone like, what would be your last meal on earth? Usually 9 times out of 10 people are like, my mom's cooking, right? So like, there's something to that comfort. At the same time, I think, in the same way that I said is like in the way people experience multiculturalism, it stops at food. I also think the way that from what I've observed, and this is kind of a hot take, is that people's kind of like organizing or their politicization almost stops just kind of like at food and like the authenticity around food and like what food represents. It's just kind of like at the same time, like you're all speaking about pho, like ICE is still detaining tons and tons of Vietnamese refugees and we're not really saying anything about that. And all these other kind of like bigger political issues in which like maybe food could be the entryway to like talk about those political things. But, you know, I always wonder about like how much it kind of stops there. Another kind of good example that we thought about and Sadie and I have written about it is just kind of like, and we have a friend, one of the people in our racist sandwich episode, Aisha, she's Yemeni Kenyan. And we've talked about like, why is there like somewhat of a renaissance in like Syrian cuisine, but you don't see the same in like Yemeni cuisine, right? And part of it is just pure immigration policy. We have promoted and, you know, rightfully so, and I think it's a good thing we should be proud of, is we've accepted Syrian refugees, and that's how you get things like Peace by Chocolate and all these other like really big like success stories about kind of like this dream of like integration, the true Canadian success story. It doesn't matter where you're from, anyone can make it here and we'll celebrate you because, you know, multiculturalism, all those kinds of things. But at the same time, like, Canada's still trading with Saudi Arabia, which is, you know, leading to the worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Yeah. And so we don't let those refugees in. And as a function, we don't see kind of that renaissance. Like, there's such an explicit connection between immigration policy and like the food we see. Another thing is like, people have complained is like, why don't we have good tacos here? And as someone from Texas, I'm sorry, Toronto does not have good tacos. I'm going to put that out there. And I've also lived in Canada. So it's like, I'm sorry, Toronto does not have good tacos. And part of it is just like, well, where are sort of Central Americans and Mexicans? And it's just like, well, we let them in because of off-season thing. They go, they pick our fruits and whatever. And then they have a temporary residence and then we force them to go back home. Like there's no pathway of citizenship here. And as a result, what incentive do they have to try to establish and, you know, not just try to survive, which is often the reason why people, at least we've heard, start restaurants. A couple that we've interviewed are like, no, we're doing this because we love cooking and we have an expression. More often than not, what we've heard is like, this was just kind of like one of the survival mechanisms we have. And it's not an ideal survival mechanism. Like, restaurants, razor thin margins, you work all the time. There's really literally no day off. And you're so dependent on like your supply. Like, if your suppliers are late, like you just don't have service for that day. A cook doesn't show up, you have to do it all. So it's not an ideal, it's really not, like, if you think about the restaurant business, like as a form of like me trying to survive, it's not, if I had an easier path, that's what I think I would, like, I don't know if I can survive a kitchen. Like, Sadie, you worked, you didn't work in a kitchen, but I know you like worked, like even being front of house is incredibly, incredibly tiring. So.
But yeah, of course, yeah. No breaks. It's just, you know, it's just, no one does it because they want to do it. Well, actually, one or two people do. It's usually like the chef and the owner, and everyone else is there because it's hard work. And I remember, the back of the kitchen, there was a Tamil guy who did, like, you know, who was the dishwasher there. And me and him just had an instant connection. And he would save me food because it was busy, right? Like, you don't get breaks, and he'd feed me and stuff like that. And it's just a lot, I just have a lot of weird stories from that time, like, we don't need to get into, but like, the thing is that like in a certain neighborhood in Yorkville in Toronto, they don't really expect to see a Bengali person or a brown person or a person of color in the front, you know. So there are a lot of situations where the customers and patrons would be like, would be surprised that I spoke English, or would be surprised that I was taking their order, or would ask me, you know, what my story was, where I was from, you know, all that sort of stuff. But
thanks for sharing that with us, Sadi. That makes me wonder, like, is it possible to kind of bring people together and facilitate a sense of ease that, like, hey, you know, this might not be what you initially signed up for, but at least you found community, at least you found people that are going to be in your corner. Like, those are things that are social capital that you can't, that comes with the dream of being integrated, right? Like, there's like the economics of like the hard, cold economics. And then there's the social capital, the things that make you really feel like you belong somewhere. It's having people know your name and know your story in a way that's not fetishizing you or making you feel like an outsider. So
no, that's a good point.
I think something that I've been thinking about a couple, like for a while now, as I'm listening to you guys talk, is just how important it is not to group up immigrants, actually. Like, I think, you know, going back to Andrew, what you were saying about the difference between how Yemeni refugees and Syrian refugees are treated in Canada. And then also even like, you know, when we're talking about what your moms think to Tina and Andrew of like eating out at a restaurant. Like, these are really stark contrasts, you know, between the experiences of different communities. And like in Iran and within the Iranian community, eating out at a restaurant in Toronto is a very common thing. You know, like there's certain dishes that are actually like specialty dishes that it's a big family kind of like fun event to go and eat it out at a restaurant. And the moms, very maybe not with every dish or with every restaurant, but they very much trust the quality of the food that's being like offered to them. And a part of that is because they're bringing here their culture of like what it's like back home, like eating out until like 2 a.m being at restaurants, being at parks, is like it's a very big part of the social life over there, you know. So by extension, like I can only speak for my community, and even within that, I can only speak to my experience within it. But I go back to this idea that like eating out at having these restaurants be visited by non-Iranians is a very positive and exciting experience for the people there. I think like how much does that speak to the other barriers, like Tahseen was mentioning, to their integration in Canada? Like, why is this one of the only ways that they feel like a moment of exposure, you know?
You're going to go on Nowruz, or you know, on a lot of holidays, you go to Iranian plazas and you see how crowded they are from the bakeries and the grocery stores and things like that, and how sort of normal it has become to see white people in Bengali restaurants, in Iranian restaurants, in a lot of restaurants, but how still uncommon it may be to see them in grocery stores or bakeries. Like, how would we feel if we saw white people in grocery stores? Like, for me, like, I can remember a few weeks back going to a Bengali grocery store and seeing, like, a white person there, and I was very surprised. And I remember I had, like, a weird reaction. Like, my reaction in my head was, like, okay, good luck. Because I was fucked up being in there. Like, I could only understand, like, 30% of what's going on, right? But at the same time, I was like, damn, okay, this guy's brave, right? Like, so I'm just curious, like, how we would feel, because we say that, like, you know, we want them to go beyond just eating at a restaurant. Like, once they go to a grocery store, would we be willing to, like, are you doing all right in here? Like, is there anything you need? Or, like, you know, how would we be?
That is not the case in an Asian grocer. I will say that right now. That is not the case there.
Well, I want to speak to that because I think two things. Like, I like, yeah, come to the Bengali grocery, come to the Persian grocery because, you know, pay me in equity, right? Like, when we say that, it means engage. Yeah, engage meaningfully. There's nothing – it's great that you want to have the cuisine and put, you know, literally put your money where your mouth is. But then if you like what you're trying and you want to bring some of that home – then buy the ingredients from the folks that own those businesses that can go back to those communities, right? And I think paying communities in equity, like giving them their business, amplifying their business if you like it, and then, you know, continuing to engage with these businesses in a meaningful way, the same way that you might be talking to somebody at like your local No Frills or whatever, hopefully you can extend that same towards like your local ethnic grocer and develop those ties so that's on the receiving end, if an immigrant mom and dad shop feels like, oh, there's people who want to engage with what we have here. Like, it's good. It's validating. It's confirming, because maybe for a lot of folks prior, the baseline belief was that we're not going to be accepted. There's like a lot of risk and fear underlining a lot of that. And I see that from my parents. I see that a lot from people that they know. Like, they're so happy to receive that taste of acceptance because they've never received it before.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you brought that up. And I think that's very, very important. And I think on the acceptance thing, I think we're kind of going through this moment we all kind of like see now in terms of like acceptance. Because like, there were cuisines that, you know, probably like half your friends can probably relate to the, you know, I call it the stinky lunch trauma, you know, that obligatory story, which everyone relates to. Like, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Right. So, and all that. And I don't want to suggest that was traumatic for me or anything, but it's like very weird where like in kindergarten, my mom would give me these sandwiches, would put sriracha in it. I'm like a 5-year-old kid. Right. And I would bring it home, not because like I was ashamed of it per se. It's just, you just don't feed a child spicy food and whatever. But I had this other Vietnamese family is like, oh, your son can really handle spicy food. I wish my children could do the same or whatever. But that's because that was forced on me. And you know, it has a smell. So, you know, kids being kids are just kind of like, oh, that's smelly, blah, blah, blah. And all these kinds of things. But at the same time, these kids also brought like dal and whatever. And I'm pretty sure I said the same thing. So it being in a very multicultural, like elementary school, and all that. And now all of a sudden you see people just unironically wearing like sriracha t-shirts where it's like, this is a thing that people would have like made fun of, but it's like such a central part of like our cuisine in a lot of ways. And now it's like accepted. So like, there's this like weird thing about like, you didn't accept this 20 years ago. Now it's like hip and cool to the point where it's just like, now you're a spokesperson for this thing. I hear the same thing with my Korean friends about like, just kind of like how kimchi has just transformed into this, like, now you get like all these like people who like pickle it themselves, which is like super cool. But then they end up being the spokesperson, or at least they perceive as like, okay, you're someone who maybe would have made fun of me 20 years ago for this. Now you're a spokesperson for this. And so like there's like, on one hand, gratitude for acceptance, I guess, but and gratitude's the wrong word. I the word struggled to escape me. But on the other hand, it's just kind of like, for lack of a better word, know your place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, a lot of the sticky lunch stories, I can't really like relate to. Obviously, identify with, and they sound like really similar mm-hmm. to mine, sort of. But like, because like, you know, everyone was brown pretty much in my middle school. That, you know, we weren't like, how can you point a gun at someone when they have the ability to point it back at you, right? Like, it's just like we all have the same shit. But I will say that like. The two things I can say on that, like earlier than that, I remember in elementary school, sometimes like my mom would on field trips or whatever, she'd pack me a lunch. And like one of the times I remember she packed me like dimbazi, which is like just like an omelet that's been fried and it's like wrapped in a roti. And it's like, it's not that bad. But like, you know, it was fried with like onions and cilantro. So maybe there's a smell to it. And I remember like opening it up and like, this thing is really tasty. Like, it's just like a really like just like a simple, basic thing. But super tasty. I remember a kid being like, yo, that stinks, man. That's really terrible, or whatever, right? Saying something. And I remember like, I remember being so like just pissed because it tasted so good and he had no idea. So I was like, you know what? How would you know? Like, you don't even know. Like, this thing tastes so good. And he's like, all right, let me try something. So like, I looked at it and I was like, you know what? This guy's an idiot. He needs to know. So I gave it to him and then he ate it. He bit into it and he ate it. And he was like, yo, this is so good. And I was like, what do you think I've been trying to fucking tell you? But I remember before I gave it to him, like right before he bit into it, I was scared shitless. I was like, what if it's all in my head? What if it's all in our head that our food actually just tastes good to us, but to them, it stinks like shit, it tastes like shit, and it's going to be horrible. Like, oh my God. But then like once he bit into it, I was like, no way in hell. Like, come on. Like, we all know, like, it tastes great. So I'm glad, like, but yeah, once we got into middle school, like, I can speak, like, as a reformed, like, kind of a piece of shit. Like, I was one of those kids who was like, yo, look at this fob bringing, like, dog to school. Like, what's going on, right? Like, my older brother went through a lot of the stinky lunch stuff. So my mom knew that like if she gave us like Bengali food or whatever to school, we would throw that stuff out. And my mom always said to us, like, I don't mind if you guys don't want to eat it, just bring it back home instead of throwing it out, like, you know. But like, but the thing is that no, that's all bullshit, because like I tried that once. At the amount of shit she gave me for like an hour, like, why did you eat it? It's like, you told me I could bring it back home if I don't want to eat it. It's like, no, it's like I made a few. So after that, I'm just like, okay, just give us hot dogs or whatever. So that's what it was. Yeah.
I personally never really felt it. I remember this one time because I would get banh mi. Very, very easy. It's sandwiches and, you know, I mean, they're French colonial influence, little tiny baguettes with these hams, sriracha, little pickles, and I would just eat that all the time. And then I remember one time, and it wasn't stinky lunch, it was more like, I want to try bologna sandwiches with like the Wonder Bread, right? Because it's just like, this is what people did. And I ate that, and I actually threw that out because it's like, how do people eat this? I, however, do remember in elementary school, and it was a really funny thing, because when you go to a very multicultural elementary school, then I went to a suburb where it's like really, where it was like not as diverse, where this one, I wanted, with like this one Korean kid like brought noodles, and like this one like Ethiopian kid was like, ew, you're eating like worms. And the kid actually punched the kid in the face, got suspended for it. But that's the thing, because you typically think the person making fun of it is like a white kid. No, it's like it's Ethiopian. So it's just kind of like, to your point about like, you can point a gun at me, I'll point a gun back. That was very much my elementary school, where this kid got suspended for fighting.
I love the idea of like the junior high school lunchroom being where all of society's shit comes to light, and I just have such a distinct memory of like us sitting at our typical lunch table, me bringing my Persian food, which smelled absolutely terrible, but it is the dish hormus sabzi is literally like, I can't even describe to you the kind of pleasure and joy it brings me. So I didn't give a shit that it smelled. My friend next to me has her delicious bibimbap and kimchi, and she shares it with us. And it was, experienced my first love of Korean food there. And then we had our poor white friend who would always just get like $20 or $10 a day to come and buy the lunchroom pizza and fries. And I remember my mom finding out about that once, and she thought it was so sad. And she thought it was like the most like depressing thing that he never got homemade food. So, you know, I think I love to think about these conversations from those times, because even if it's a bad thing that came out during those years, because we weren't consciously thinking about all of these different societal factors, it was just so, I always look back at that time with such like fondness, you know, like no one there, even if someone made a comment about someone else's food, it was so innocent. It really was. So I'm glad to wrap this conversation up on that note.